welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our deep values, the things that we try and stay loyal to as we navigate life, and particularly the deep values of those who have some kind of public voice or platform and who shape and form our common life. I'm really interested in their starting point, their ethical view of the world, if you will, and particularly how understanding these things might help us grow in empathy and curiosity and ability to live together in our very diverse communities. You can listen back to 5 years worth of interviews with public figures from all over the world, different professions, different politics, completely different perspectives. And my hope is that you will listen to people who affirm you in what you think and in your identity and in your beliefs, and also people who challenge you. But in so doing, you will begin to see and understand what might be driving people who are not like yourself and who you disagree with. In this episode, I spoke to Tomowa Olade. Tomowa is a journalist and a writer, and his recent book, This Is Not America, was published in 2023. We had a really interesting conversation about his experiences growing up in Nigeria and then moving to South London, and what drove him to try and write with a bit more granularity and particularity about the Black British experience. There are some reflections from me at the end, as usual. In the meantime, I really hope you enjoy the conversation. Tom, we are going to kick off today with a non-standard opening question. It's the morning. We're both of us still coming to, so it might feel a little bit, you know, hearts, minds, soul, spirit coming into gearing up for it. I'm going to ask you what is sacred to you. And you can take that in any direction you like. You can make of it what you like. You can reject the premise of the question. But it's really trying to get to your deep principles and values. What do you think is sacred to you?
The thing that I consider to be sacred is any sense of community, whether that community manifests itself in terms of family, in terms of religion, in terms of friendship groups, in terms of civic institutions within a city or a town, in terms of a football team. Because what I consider to be sacred is something that takes you outside of your individual self.
That's so interesting. Do you know, do you have a sense of why? Why that's sacred to you?
I think the reason why that's sacred to me is because I believe that we live in an increasingly atomized society. And I think this explains why many of our politics feels so divisive and so polarizing. I think the reason why much of our politics feels divisive and polarizing, and by politics, I don't just mean politics in terms of Conservative or Labour Party. I also mean politics in terms of some of the most contentious issues in our day, arguments around race and trans rights and feminism. I think the reason why they're so polarizing and divisive is because there isn't enough space in society at the moment for people to find the sacred. Many of our civic institutions are in decline. Religion as an organizing force in civil society is in decline. There is family breakdown. Friendships today are often mediated through social media rather than grounded in reality. And I feel that because of that, people try to find what's sacred in things like their own individual identity rather than in grander civic institutions.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll come back to that and how that kind of anti-individualism strain shows up in your politics. But for now, we're going to go, we're going to wind right back and try and get a sense of you at the beginning of your story. And I'd love to hear what were some big ideas present in your childhood, whether religious or political or philosophical, and they could have been explicit or implicit. What was in the air when young Tom was growing up?
So I was born in Nigeria, and I moved to the UK when I was 9. I come from...
Let's start with that first chapter. Do you mind? The Nigerian 9 years.
Yeah, what sure. Was,
paint me a word picture.
Yeah, so I grew up in a Christian family. Church of England, officially. But if you grew up in a Church of England West African family, there's always an evangelical spice to it, an evangelical dimension to it. The average Church of England, and by Church of England, I mean like Anglican, the average Anglican West African church is very different to the average Anglican church in England. So there's always a slightly evangelical twang to it. So the atmosphere in my childhood and even as a teenager was always necessarily one shaped by Christianity. In terms of culture, I also consumed a lot of American action films. And I watched a lot of wrestling, WWE or WWF, as it was known in the past as well. So I consumed a lot of American culture. And I guess that must have shaped my outlook and things as well.
Yeah.
But I also consumed a lot of British media as well, a lot of British culture. I was a big fan of the show Mr. Bean. I also
feel like he's the most recognizable physical comedy in the world, right? It's just like the way Mr. Bean traveled is extraordinary. Yeah,
exactly.
Because you don't have to translate it.
Yeah, you don't need to translate it. It's like, and it has that universal appeal. So I guess maybe the consistent theme across my being a child is that a lot of the culture that I consumed from the stories in the Bible to the action films of Arnold Schwarzenegger to the comedy of Mr. Bean were things that had a universal appeal. And maybe that's in a strange way shaped the kind of ideas and the politics that I espouse, which is a kind of curiosity about other cultures, especially Western cultures, kind of universalism, maybe.
I wanted to hear a little bit about more about your family, about what your mom and dad sure. were like if they were both around. Do you have siblings? Was it big, small, noisy, quiet?
Yeah. So I was the I was the youngest in my family, the fourth child, and I've got three older brothers, no sisters.
It's also making, I think a therapist would say that your obsession with wrestling and being a superhero makes a lot of sense as the fourth son.
maybe. Both my parents were around. My dad used to be a politician in Nigeria. He's now retired. And my mom used to basically... buy and sell clothes. So she was a trader, essentially, in clothes and also other goods as well. So the dynamic in my family was that I was the youngest. And growing up as a child, I think I was the most shy as well, out of all my family members. And when I moved to the UK as well, I was also quite shy as well. And I would still consider myself a shy person, even though other people might disagree. And I think the reason why other people might disagree is because when I meet people, when I interact with people, I tend to ask them a lot of questions. But that's almost like a kind of defense mechanism to protect my shyness.
What was that transition like when you moved? What made your mum and dad move? And what was that emotional experience like, maybe that first year settling into school, a new place, a new home?
They decided to move, to give me and my brothers a better education, basically. The process was smooth in some respects and a bit strange in other respects. So it was smooth in the respects of English is the official language of Nigeria. So I grew up speaking and understanding English as a child in Nigeria. And also I consumed a lot of, as I said earlier, a lot of British and American popular culture. So in terms of culture, it wasn't that much of a shift. I think the biggest shift that I noticed was in terms of education. So in Nigerian schools at that time, even in primary schools, corporal punishment was still in use. So kids used to be caned for any transgression that they did, basically, including me. I was caned a few times as well. So I found English, British teachers far more lenient and far more generous than their Nigerian counterparts. I think another difference is that in Nigerian, or more generally in West African, and I also think this is true in Asian culture as well, if you see somebody that's an adult or a friend of your parents, more specifically, you would either refer to them as Mr. or Mrs. or Ms. or uncle or auntie, even though they're not related to you. Whereas in the UK, if you're a child and you see an adult, you can call that adult by their first name. So that was another interesting cultural dynamic that I found fascinating to navigate through.
And you moved to South London immediately, is that right? To kind of Plumstead area?
Yeah, so I grew up in I grew up in two parts of Southeast London. I grew up in the Plumstead area, but I also grew up for some time in Eltham as well. That's an interesting part of Southeast London because the Plumstead area in particular has a very large Black African population. So in a sense, I even though I left Nigeria. In a sense, you could argue, did I really leave Nigeria? If I grew up in Plumstead and Woolwich and areas around there. So there was definitely a very large, a very large Black African population. Eltham is a fascinating place because Eltham was where Stephen Lawrence was tragically murdered in 1993. And Eltham historically has been a stronghold for the far right, interestingly enough. And what makes this fascinating is that I didn't really know this until I was much older. So this is something I only knew in retrospect, the far right, white supremacist legacy of Eltham. And what makes it also fascinating is that I went to school near Eltham as well. So I went to school in a place called Kidbrook, which is near Blackheath, for those of you that don't know. or near Greenwich. The school I went to was very ethnically diverse. And I didn't really experience any kind of explicit racism when I was at that school. But just like a stone's throw away is an area that has a far-right white supremacist legacy. So I found that disjunction in retrospect fascinating.
It's interesting, and one of the things that comes up a lot in your book is the particularity of Black people's narratives, right? How much we want to put, and we don't just do this with race, we do this with everything. We want to have a kind of set of narrative tracks or narrative options and put people in them. And the way that immigrant experience is often narrated, particularly those who are moving from a Black majority country or from a country that's less dominant in white people, as the UK is, that there's a sense of dislocation or a kind of painful coming to awareness of the immigrant's own different racial identity and a sense of alienation. And I think that is how a lot of immigrants would narrate their coming to the UK. From what I've read and what I can hear, the experience was just quite straightforward for you. Is that right? And if so, why do you think that might have been?
Yeah, it is. I think there would have been a greater sense of dislocation or alienation if I came from, say, a Francophone country in Africa, or if I came, say, from a majority Muslim country in Africa or across the rest of the world. Nigeria is interesting because Nigeria is about 50% Muslim and 45% Christian. So it's almost 50-50. But if I came from, and I'm from the Christian side, so if I came from a majority Christian country and my family was, I mean, a majority Muslim country and my family was also Muslim as well, then I might feel that sense of cultural alienation or dislocation. And I think it's also because I also come from quite a proud and quite a strong family community. So I've never really felt any sense of confusion about my identity as well. So I think it's a mixture of all those different factors, which meant that I didn't really have any sense of alienation or any desperate desire to find a different sort of identity when I moved to the UK.
And I realise this is, particularly for British people, quite a private question, but how much did and does your parents' Christianity continue to feature in your childhood and maybe in your life now?
It's still an ever-present feature, and it's something which is integral to I think it's something which is integral to my identity, because it's something which has definitely shaped my moral and cultural outlook. And the funny thing, and this is the strange irony of it, is that Christianity was only introduced to West Africa from the middle of the 19th century onwards.
Wow.
And I think that in terms of my own particular family, Christianity was only introduced by the late 19th century on my father's side, and the early 20th century on my mother's side, possibly. It's a bit murky. I'm trying to trace the exact moment my family became Christian. So in grand historical terms, it's very recent. But it nevertheless feels like an integral part of the identity of my family. And the reason why I find it funny is because when we're thinking of being a Christian and being British, it's been an integral part of British identity for over 1,000 years, for like 1,000 and more, and hundreds and hundreds of years. But in terms of my own identity, and the identity of Black African people in the UK, it's only been a big part of the identity for a far shorter period of time. And the reason why I find it interesting and ironic is because, as I've written before, Christianity amongst the white British population is in decline in terms of considering yourself to be a Christian, which I think is slightly different from actually going to church every week. So I do think that there is a difference between identifying with Christianity and actually practicing it every single week and every single day. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the Black African population in the UK, it's still a massive part of the identity. So it's funny that something that was essentially an imperial or colonial export is now being brought back to the metropole.
So you were at a comprehensive school in Plumstead, very mixed, not feeling a sense of alienation or dislocation. And then you're getting ready to go to university and a teacher suggests going to SOAS. Yeah. Could you tell me a little bit about that moment and why it felt meaningful?
Yeah. So when I was applying to go to university, this was when I was 17 and I was thinking of applying to various universities. One of my teachers suggested I go to SOAS University in London. And the reason why she said that is because she thought SOAS was great because SOAS has a legacy or a tradition of being welcoming to people of ethnic minority backgrounds. And the reason why I responded in a negative way to that, so I responded in a negative and quite a viscerally negative way to that suggestion, because I found it to be completely patronizing. I found it to be something that reduced me to my identity and not to any sort of educational qualification that I have, independent of my particular racial identity. And this was at a time when I didn't really have the kind of arguments that I do now. I didn't really think about race in the same particular way that I do now. I wasn't really familiar with many of the thinkers of race that I am with now, or many of the arguments and debates on those matters that I do now. But I felt that visceral response because I think, as I intimated earlier, I come from quite a proud family. And I'm always quite sensitive to anybody that I consider to be condescending or to be patronizing to me. And I also have quite a strong sense of not always wanting to be viewed as just a Black person and nothing else, because I know that I'm more than that. And I think perhaps one of the reasons why I felt that is because I come from a country, I was born and raised in a country where over 99% of the population is Black. So in Nigeria, being Black is not one of the main, it's not like a social dividing line, because everyone is Black. The dividing lines within Nigerian society are based on things like religion, ethnic tribal group, region in a country, politics, class, all those other various factors rather than race. So when I was growing up in Nigeria, race was not at the front of my mind as it would be if you were born in a majority white country and you're a black person. So being black, to me, even though, of course, I am a black person, it's not something, it's not the be-all and end-all of my identity. And I felt that that woman was turning it into that by suggesting I go to SOAS simply because I come from an ethnic minority group and therefore I would benefit from that. I found that extremely patronizing and extremely something that was not consistent with how I saw myself, essentially.
Yeah. And you ended up going to UCL, is that right?
So I went to Queen Mary, University of London, for my undergraduate degree. Then I went to UCL for a master's.
Yes. And came to the realization that you wanted to be a writer. Given that you've said what you've said, what was there a temptation to not write about race? What has drawn you into this conversation where it is both not central to your sense of self, but something that you feel compelled to speak about?
Yeah. And this is something that I've been ruminating on for quite a long while. And I think the reason why I decided to write about it is because I found the conversation and the discourse about it so frustrating to witness. And that I felt compelled to give my two cents on the topic. So in the summer of 2020...
Ironic American reference there, sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was deliberate. That was deliberate on my part. In the summer of 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, I found the conversation around race in the UK to be frustrating because I felt that these conversations did not reflect the complex realities of Black British people. So, for example, I saw many well-meaning, progressive British activists using terms like BIPOC to refer to ethnic minority people in the UK. Now, BIPOC is an acronym that stands for Black Indigenous People of Colour. A term like that would make sense in America because, of course, America has discriminated against and oppressed its various indigenous Native American communities. But using a term like indigenous in a UK context is a bit strange, especially if you are a progressive activist. It's the kind of term that you would expect somebody like a member of the BNP, the British National Party, a far-right group to use, rather than a progressive left-wing activist from UCL. So that was the most, at that time, that was the most vivid illustration of something of a more wider phenomenon that I was observing, which was that all too often when we talk and when we think about race and racism in the UK, we do it through an American perspective. And I thought at the time, and I still do now, of course, that this is completely inconsistent with the actual complex experiences of Black British people. So I would argue that the Black British population is very much an immigrant group. If you are Black and British, the majority of Black and British people are either immigrants or the children of immigrants. Whereas in America, if you are a Black American, the overwhelming majority of Black Americans can trace their ancestry further back than the majority of white Americans. And that's funny. That's because of immigration to America, from Europe, after the end of slavery, basically, after the, mid 19th century. And there has always been a substantial, Black minority in America. It's now 13% today. Whereas in the UK, the share of the British population that's Black is 4%. And 30 years ago, or maybe even 40 years ago, it was about 1%. And there are so many cities and towns in America where the majority of the population is Black. So if you are in America and you live in one of those cities and towns, your social circle essentially can be exclusively Black. Whereas in the UK, the city with the largest share of its population that's Black is London, and it's about 14%. And in the UK, we don't have the legacy of segregation that America has. So in the UK, for example, interracial marriage has never been banned in the UK. Black and ethnic minority people have never been barred from standing for electoral office or voting in elections. Black and ethnic minority men, I should, of course, emphasize.
Thank you.
So that particular legacy of institutionalized segregation in America simply doesn't translate to a UK context.
Mm. Yeah, it was really helpful reading just how big some of those differences are. And the other thing that really comes through is how much there is a real sense of distinctiveness about different groups of Black immigrants to the UK. And you really highlight this difference between people who came here as part of the Windrush generation with a Black Caribbean heritage, who obviously, similar to Black Americans, had ended up in the Caribbean because of slavery, and those more recent and bigger influx of Black African immigrants directly from Africa, from places like Nigeria, like you did, and Ghana and other places more recently. Could you just spell out why you think that distinction is really important to hold in our minds when we're thinking about the Black British experience?
Sure. Yeah. So I think many people, when they think of what it means to be Black and British, still think of it in terms of Black Caribbean people. So many people still think that Black Caribbean people constitute the majority of the Black British population. But that's not the case. The striking thing is, as of today, there are twice as many Black African people in the UK as there are Black Caribbean people. 25 years ago, the majority of Black British people were Black Caribbean people. But over the past 25 years, there's been a massive influx of immigration from Africa, which has completely changed the demographic makeup of the Black British population. In terms of the differences between Black Caribbean people and Black African people, I think looking at education is a fascinating and striking way to tease out the differences between these two groups. So in terms of education, Black African pupils have a higher GCSE and A-level attainment rate than Black Caribbean pupils. Black African pupils tend to do better in terms of GCSEs and A-levels. In terms of being excluded from schools as well, Black Caribbean pupils are three times more likely to be permanently excluded from schools than Black African pupils. And I think these differences are important if we genuinely care about the inequalities in our society. Because if we genuinely care about making our society more inclusive and more fair and more equal, we need to focus on the Black communities that are actually struggling rather than making generalizations about what it means to be Black and British. And I think this is important more generally when we talk about ethnic minority people in the UK. So the ethnic minority groups that have the best GCSE and A-level results and also do the best when it comes to going to universities are British Indian pupils and British Chinese pupils as well.
And they tend to do better than the white population, right?
And yes, they do. They do. They tend to do, quite a lot better than white population, actually. Yeah. And also, they also tend to do better than the white population in terms of things like the way that they interact with the criminal justice system. And by that, I mean that British Chinese people are actually less likely to be stopped and searched, for example, than the white population. Mm. And I think that this is important because we have this particular paradigm in our minds of there is a group of white people in this country that are privileged, and there's a group of ethnic minority people in this country that are not privileged, that suffer discrimination and oppression in terms of education, in terms of employment, in terms of their interaction with the criminal justice system. Mm. And this kind of paradigm is too simplistic because there are nuances within it. So when people say ethnic minority people in the UK are struggling, I always ask them, which ethnic minority people? Because the experiences of British Indian people are very different to the experiences of British Pakistani people. Hmm. The experiences of British Nigerian and British Ghanaian people are very different to the experiences of British Jamaican people. And I think teasing out these nuances is absolutely crucial because race is not the only thing that defines inequality in our society. Race can shape inequality. I'm not denying that.
Yeah.
But inequality can also be shaped by other factors, such as class, such as geography, such as religion, such as the family background of a particular individual, such as the cultural environment in which they were raised, mm-hmm. Such as their own individual character as well. All these various factors can shape the circumstances and the particular experiences of an individual. And I think just defining somebody in terms of their race means that we can't have an accurate picture of inequality in our society. And this is completely contrary to the central organizing mission of well-meaning progressive and liberal people, which is to improve the lives of disadvantaged people in our society. Mm. Well, you can't improve their lives if you just look at them through one dimension.
Yeah. I'm going to have a go at summarizing what I think, well, it's not your whole argument, but part of what your argument is and I'd love you to correct me if I'm wrong, because I've been sort of sitting with this sort of summary in my head, and it's that it's essentially a kind of material argument. It's a it's not that class trumps race, but that class and race are much more closely entwined than we think. And I the way I was thinking about it in my head all the way through the book is the legacy of slavery, is the way that British Caribbean people and Black American people were forcibly removed from their land and their resources, and then forcibly restrained from building up capital for generations. Whereas more recent immigrants from Africa, but also from other countries, people of color from different, basically, essentially economic, hard economic and material circumstances in their pasts, are coming from a completely different place. And that therefore, and you're very clear in your book that you're not arguing that racism doesn't exist. You're sometimes accused of kind of downplaying or denying racism. I didn't read that at all. Your chapter on the Windrush scandal is extremely angry, and rightly so, about what has happened to Black Caribbean immigrants, even in the last decade. You know, you're saying racism exists, but that much of the difficulties and the challenge that these most disadvantaged Black groups experience are the legacy of racist structures from centuries ago, of the way colonial plays out and the way that slavery plays out. And yes, there is still a kind of cultural racism in the air. People still have prejudices, but that most of the race conversation is focusing on those, on the language used now, on, you know, diversity schemes. Yeah. When actually what needs to happen is a much more structural, actually I want to ask you about reparations and what you think about them, but the way this plays out much more simply in your argument is for something like publishing in the arts, don't do loads of diversity schemes to try and get more people of color in your industries, pay them more because they don't have generational wealth, so they can't afford to be underpaid.
Yeah, exactly.
Pay people more, don't dress it up as diversity. Exactly. That's not a very good summary of your argument, but that's what I've been taking from it. Is that fair?
No, the last bit was actually a very good summary of part of my argument.
Okay.
I think actually that is a good summary. I think all of it is a good summary of my argument. I think that arguments about diversity and inclusion should be rooted more in material reality. And you were right to point out the legacy, the particular legacy of slavery in terms of the Black Caribbean experience. I think what I would also add as well to complement it is that it's material, but it's also, in a sense, cultural as well, because Black Caribbean people, and this is also true of Black American people as well, of course, they were not just expelled from their ancestral homelands and removed from any source of resources and economic capital, but they also had their language taken from them. They also had their sense of ethnic or tribal or communal affiliation removed from them.
That sacred value of community.
And so they... Exactly, the value of community, exactly. And they also had their cultural roots taken from them. And so they needed to find other sources of culture. They needed to develop their own culture to almost compensate for this particular loss, for this particular lack. And that particular historical experience simply doesn't translate to the Black African experience, because when I was growing up, even when I was in the UK, my family still often spoke to me in the language of my ancestors. I still have a West African, in particular Yoruba, name. So that kind of cultural It goes back to what we were saying earlier about cultural dislocation and cultural alienation. That's simply not the case for many Black African people in the UK. So it's a mixture of those factors, the material circumstances, and also the fact that, for example, and this goes back to what we were saying earlier about the experiences of Black Caribbean people in British education, the fact that, for example, when many of the Windrush generation came over in the 50s and 60s and sent their children to British schools, and the racism that they experienced, that their children experienced in British schools, for instance, being consigned rather unfairly to special educational institutions, the experience of being told that they were loud or being rowdy or being uncivilized by British teachers, I think that did generate a level of mistrust between many Black Caribbean communities and the British educational establishment. But Black African people simply don't have that historical experience in general. I'm speaking of generalities because most Black African people came over 25, 30 years ago to the UK.
Yeah. I wanted to read you a little book, a little bit from your book where you're quoting from Ralph Ellison, who wrote a novel called Invisible Man. And he's, I believe, a Black American thinker.
Yes.
As I read it, I had such a strong sense of, is this speaking for you? Is this sort of your voice? Ellison's unnamed narrator and protagonist is invisible because his experiences are not viewed on their own terms. They're viewed through a narrow ideological perspective. White progressive liberals simply see him as a victim who needs to be rescued. Black nationalists only see him as a vehicle for righteous indignation against racism. Both of these groups are different, but they share one thing in common. They only see him for his race and nothing else. How much did you feel like the invisible man when you were reading that book?
All of it is me, basically. And I think that's the reason why that particular novel resonated so much with me, is because even though, of course, it's a Black American experience rather than a Black British experience, it resonated with me so vividly because I feel that way as well. I feel that different groups and communities only see me for my race and not for my complex individuality, other aspects of my identity, which are not reducible to my racial background. And I think what was most striking about reading that novel is the emphasis on humanity. So a kind of humanism, which I feel has been lost in a lot of discussions about diversity, inclusion, equality. I feel that sense of a kind of universal humanity, a sense of common humanity that transcends all these categories, I feel that's been lost. And reading that novel, I felt a great kinship with the unnamed narrator of that novel, the protagonist of that novel, because I too feel that my sense of humanity has been obscured by emphasizing my racial background to the exclusion of other aspects of my identity.
Mm. And you've published this book, and in classic fashion, I kind of noticed some of the noise around the book, some positive and some negative, and then read the book and I'm always astonished by how something can be made to sound massively less nuanced than it is. It's a very careful, quite stats heavy, extremely nuanced book. And as I said, it seems to me that your argument is racism exists. Racism is bad. It plays out in different places in different ways. And I haven't experienced a lot of it, so I'd rather not have all of the anti-racism stuff focused at me. Like, let's help the people who need help. But that's a controversial thing to say in our current febrile debates around race.
Of course.
Why is complexifying the narrative, why do you think that people don't like it when you complexify the narrative? And what has the experience been of several Black thinkers really taking issue with what you're saying?
So I think the reason why people don't want to make the narrative more complex is because they think when we are trying to advance a social justice cause, we need to do it with great simplicity. When we are trying to argue something on the street, we need to simplify. And because I think they associate trying to make things more complex with a kind of distance and a kind of alien academia, like as if somebody's been in a sort of ivory tower, whereas on the streets, we need to keep things as simple and as straightforward as possible.
Because that's how we motivate change.
And even though my arguments of... Exactly. That's how we make genuine change, by simple rhetoric, essentially. But even though you rightly say that my arguments are very... or try to be very complex and very nuanced and so forth, I also try to write in a sort of simple, not simple, that's the wrong word, but in a clear way, as much as I can, in a clear and lucid way. But I also think that many people, many Black thinkers have issue with my arguments and my point of view. Because they think that racial solidarity should trump everything, basically. That all these arguments about the differences between Black Africans and Black Caribbean people, or the differences between Black middle class and Black working class people, all of this is irrelevant at the end of the day because of the overwhelming force of white supremacy, basically. And on the basis of that, we should emphasize the importance of racial solidarity. But I think this is a problem because Black people that live in Africa, for example, as I intimated earlier, we shouldn't assume that they would necessarily share the same kind of progressive views on race and on equality as many Black activist people in the Western diaspora would, because there are many Black people in Africa that might be conservative. They might be more focused on other things apart from race, and we should not necessarily assume that they share the same views and the same assumptions simply on the basis of the fact that they are Black. And related to this as well is that it's possible to express solidarity with somebody on the basis of shared values and shared principles rather than on the basis of a shared racial identity. So a white British person might feel a sense of kinship with the struggles of Black American people, for example. And that white British person might feel that kinship because that white British person has a particular set of values and principles which explains why they have that shared kinship in the first place. Principles such as anti-racism, anti-economic inequality, maybe anti-capitalism, all these values and principles might shape the way that they express solidarity. and that solidarity which transcends race. So I would say that I can understand why there is a kind of emphasis on racial solidarity, but we shouldn't necessarily assume that, because Black people are humans, and humans are complex by their very nature, and diverse in terms of their preferences and their characteristics as well. And the sort of, as a complement to that, solidarity, I think, can be more powerfully expressed through shared values and principles. And just to go back to what many of my detractors have been saying about my book, is did you read that review by Kenby Andrews?
Yeah, which made a lot more sense once I got to the part in your book where you take a pop at him, and I was like, okay, there's just beef here.
So some people have argued that I'm a kind of a source of race traitor, essentially, that I'm a traitor to the cause. And I always find this sort of argument rather amusing, because and this goes back again to me being a child. So I think another thing which I don't think I've emphasized in this interview is even though I emphasize the importance of community and belonging, I've always been also as well, this is a strange paradox about me. I've always been a bit
contrarian,
resistant to being part of a tribe. Sorry, I've always been resistant to being part of a tribe.
Yeah.
To being part of one single tribe. I've always found that claustrophobic, to be sort of consigned to one particular. So when I was at school, for example, at school, like, loads of people were in like different cliques and different friendship groups. I was one of those kids that was in different friendship groups, was in different cliques. I was friendly with the kids of school that were interested in football and sport, but I was also friendly with the kids that were more academically orientated as well. So I've always been, and this is something that's carried on to me being an adult as well. I don't belong to one particular friendship group as well as an adult. So the idea of belonging to the tribe of Black British people, or the tribe of Black British academic people, I'm always very resistant to. There is something, because and it's striking, because I'm quite an agreeable person. I don't enjoy arguments and disputation and verbal fisticuffs. But there is, and this is a phrase that was used by the 19th century American writer. There's a bit of the imp of the perverse in me, which is there's a kind of subversive sensibility within me, which always resists any kind of tribal affiliation. Mm-hmm. So I find all these allegations of being like a sort of race traitor amusing more than anything else.
Tomiya Owolade, thank you so much for speaking to me on The Sacred.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth.
So much to chew on after talking to Tom, and perhaps starting with the bookends, really, the beginning and the end of the conversation, where he said the sacred value is community, that it is something beyond the individual. And this is a real dividing line. You can kind of tell someone who is not explicitly or straightforwardly a liberal, someone who's kind of has a political, temperamental lean towards liberalism, would almost never challenge the premise of the sacred as an individual thing. It is inherently for them a collective or a communal thing. I think it is, guests challenge me on that repeatedly. And I really love the different directions that people can take that question. He said community at the beginning, a sense of belonging, a pushing back against an individualism and atomization. And at the end, he so helpfully kind of laughingly reflected that there's two poles in him. One is to community and communalism. And then the other is this slightly more allergy to getting swept up in things, to homogeneity, maybe some days tendencies to kind of be a controversialist, to take the minority opinion, and how those two things live within him. And it's just so helpful, I think, to complexify and to name how complex we are as individuals, how we can have slightly different values, temperaments, tendencies, even on different days ourselves. I think that's the theme of this interview with Tom, is just that many things can be true at the same time. And it's really left me with this sense of how much I want a simple story, how much I want, in literary theory, it's called synecdoche. I've never said that out loud. I think it's said synecdoche, synecdoche, it's written, which means the part standing for the whole. And I think we really want that. We really want to be able to listen to one person's story and go, okay, I understand the experience of X. To not have to do the thing that Cole Arthur Riley challenged us with in an earlier interview, which is unapologetic and rigorous particularity. To listen to people's stories, you know, and we can't possibly listen to each one, right? We can't possibly treat each person with the same level of attention. But we can realize how much our cognitive shortcuts can trip us up when we go. And I feel it in myself. I'm like, but I just want to understand race. It's just a ridiculous thing to have a think. Or, you know, in lots of areas, you know, want to be an informed person, informed citizen. I'm going to read a few books about this topic. I'm going to listen to a few podcasts about this topic. And then I want to feel like I've got it, you know, like I understand it. Like I can narrate the experience of Black British people or the experience of trans people, or I can understand the climate crisis or whatever it is. And this podcast again and again just like whacks me in the face with the futility of that, but also the unavoidability of that, because no one has infinite time, attention, or capacity to issues. And I think we probably need to just decide which things, areas, issues we're going to go deep with, but make sure in the ones we just haven't got that RAM for, we're not assuming that we understand when we've only dipped our toe in. So yeah, Tom's childhood, being able to say, yes, I grew up where Stephen Lawrence was killed and I didn't experience explicit racism in my childhood. Being able to say, yes, racism exists. It's bad and we need to fight against it. And it doesn't show up in the same way for different people, and a level of granularity is helpful. And I think it was such a key point that, you know, he is accused of being a traitor or, you know, these kind of words that are used against people of color, like coconut and, you know, brown on the outside, white on the inside, those names that he's been called and others get called for trying to say, this is not my experience. My experience is different. I remember it when Me Too came, kind of hit us in the face, and this sense of like, whose part gets to stand for the whole? Whose individual particular story do we let become representative in the public mind? And for a lot of older feminists, I think, or women who hadn't experienced sexual violence, there was this sense in which there was this realization of, okay, because I haven't experienced these things doesn't mean they didn't happen. But then I think for those that they had happened to, I can't really follow through my point in that, but just this sense in which we're continually wanting to work out who is representative, right? Whose story can we file under that's what it's like to be X. And if Tom's left me with anything, it's the resistance to that. Yeah. And how we need to navigate that in ourselves and others. I find it when I'm telling my story of, I'm writing about this at the moment, I'm trying to write about the Christian sexual ethic and my experience of it, having been broadly positive. But I'm having to be, and rightly so, so careful to not sound like I'm saying my story invalidates the stories of others whose experience is different. And that instinct in us to feel delegitimized or denied by someone else's different story, I think trips us up a huge amount. It was really interesting what he said about the Christianity basically being a colonial export, which is being exported back in. And he's right. London, some Theos research showed, is the most religious place in the UK. And it's largely because of the very vibrant immigrant religious communities. Him saying, I think, so trying to get my head around Tom and what's formed him and why he feels this distinctiveness or difference or kind of divergence from the from some of the stories that are told about Black people in the UK. And I think really key was this sense that he said, like, growing up in Nigeria, he wasn't Black. He was just a person. I don't think he put it like that. But it wasn't that he wasn't Black, it's that everyone was Black, and therefore it wasn't a salient fact about his identity. It wasn't in a thing that other people were using, didn't come with associations. It was just what people looked like. And then being thrust into a society in which his Blackness was, in the eyes of other people, extremely salient to his identity, I think is part of what's been going on for him. And it makes me think about how those of us who are Caucasian, as this language has changed and awareness has changed over the last few years, I know a lot of people who find talk of whiteness quite difficult to sit with and can feel kind of triggered into a defensiveness. And I'm sure there are situations in which it's being used in ways in which that reaction is perhaps justified. But I wonder if part of what's going on is that those of us who grew up in white majority places and are white, it wasn't a salient aspect of our identity. It just isn't part of our self-conception. And so when someone else comes along and says, you know, this is really salient to your identity, this is key to how I see you, maybe we're experiencing something not dissimilar to the journey that Tom has gone on. And I think the thing will maybe stay with me the most was just the sense of like material reality around race. And I wish I'd kept hold of the thread of my thought and said, what do you think about reparations? Because I think in reading his argument, I came to a stronger sense of the strength of the argument for reparations. That if what you're seeing in the difference between a directly immigrated kind of West African Black British population and a Caribbean Black British population, if Tom is right and his data is right and their experience is so different and the kind of markers around poverty and social exclusion and school attainment are so different, some of it will be culture, I'm sure, and some of it will be when those populations arrived and the level of hostility that they experienced. But you've just got to go, slavery begins to loom extremely large as one of the hypotheses for that difference, that level of uprooting, both in terms of economic outcomes and in the way that forms people. I talked to Vanessa Zoltan about kind of generational trauma and epigenetics and the way, you know, to the third generation of Holocaust survivors, the children of Holocaust survivors to the third generation have much higher levels of depression, anxiety, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, possibly a tangent, but it works out in very simple ways in Tom's argument sometimes, where he's like, yeah, don't start a big diversity agenda in publishing, just pay people properly. And that feels very sane to me. Yeah, this interview has just left me with this commitment to the bit of my brain that wants things to be simple needs to be kept an eye on. And that surrendering to the mystery and complexity, and in Cole Arthur Royley's phrase, the sort of unapologetic particularity of each human person in front of me, that's the posture that I want to adopt. And I think Tom is inviting us into that. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sacred Podcast. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield. The podcast is a project of the think tank Theos. You can find all about our work at theosthinktank.co.uk. Our production team are Dan Turner and Fiona Howarth. We're edited by Drew Hawley, and our music is by Luke Stanley, with lyrics by Lizzie Harvey. I really hope that you'll share the episode, let us know what you thought, leave a review. They really do warm my heart. There's been some really helpful feedback in some of the reviews that we've taken on board. I love chatting to you. I love hearing from you. I think you're the most extraordinary group of people. So please do be in touch. Until next time.